This season is entitled Young Hearts. As well as three new or newly translated plays, Che Walker's Frontline, Trevor Griffith's New World about Tom Paine, and Frank McGuinness's translation of Euripides' Helen, there are four by Shakespeare, all in their different ways dealing with young love. Romeo and Juliet has already opened, Troilus and Cressida, and a revival of Dominic Bromgoole's production of Love's Labour's Lost are promised. But next to open is As You Like It, directed by Thea Sharrock, who joins me now in a Globe rehearsal room while we have a few minutes while the actors are having their lunch. Thea is a young director, has already run two theatres, Southwark Playhouse and the Gate, and has productions at the National Theatre, the Almeida and the Donmar to her credit, as well as Equus starring Daniel Radcliffe in the West End. But this is her first foray into Shakespeare. You're starting at the Globe. What a place to start.
I know. Makes sense, though, doesn't it, really? If you're going to dive in, you might as well dive in the deep end.
Now, have you had the company up on the stage?
Yes. Actually, we did that quite early on. Because it's so completely unique here, I encourage that as much as possible. So, we've had a couple of group sessions, as it were, on there, voice things. And also, I said to the actors right at the beginning of rehearsals that every day when they had just to come in 5 minutes early or to take 5 minutes at the end of the day, just poke your head into the auditorium, no matter what's going on. And obviously, if there's a show going on, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. But just try every day to have a little bit of time in there, albeit a minute or a couple of minutes, just to try and learn something new about the space every time and your relationship to it, because it is so completely unlike anywhere else.
Have you got any actors who've been here before?
I've got quite a few, actually. I'd say probably at least a third, if not maybe nearly half.
Because that helps, doesn't it?
It does. It's so we've got a really nice balance. Yeah. We've got those who've never played it but seen things here and so have impressions, formed as an audience member. Yeah. And then quite a few who have played it. And I've got, of the ones who've played it, quite a few of them have done it more than once. So they've learnt the first time and gone back and learnt again.
Yes.
So it's nice. It's a really nice balance.
And are you using Elizabethan costume?
We are. For this one, we are, yeah. Mm-hmm. Just felt on that stage, I didn't want to put a concept onto this production, particularly, as I say, because of this particular space. I think you can actually start the evening off by slightly confusing your audience rather than just simply serving up the story, which is what I'm aiming to do.
Yes. Well, this one's certainly about love, isn't it?
In
all
its guises. Yeah, there's a lot of different people falling in and out of love all over the place, yeah.
Yes, and satire on love and people who are obviously going to be in love for a very short time, probably, and some who perhaps are for life.
In love for life, yeah. Although I'm sort of hoping that even the ones you think are only going to last for a short while, they might surprise us.
So we're talking about Touchstone here.
Well, I'm certainly talking about Touchstone, yeah.
Well, that's an amazing part, isn't it?
It is quite a part, yeah.
Yes.
And I think it's the biggest of the fools. And the tenor of it is very different to the fools, if you like, that preceded this play, because this was the moment in Shakespeare's life where Will Kemp, his clown, as it were, left the company, and he needed to find someone new, and he did. And this was this was very much the beginning of where he then. Mm.
This was Robert Armin.
Robert Armin, who then went on and did The Fool in Lear.
Yes.
And so the links are absolutely there. It's very sort of interesting to follow the line. Yeah.
Have you cut any of him? I wondered if you might have.
Do you know, I thought I was going to cut loads of it because it's so difficult and dense. But of course, me sitting alone at home with the script trying to work out, which bits are absolute gold dust and which bits actually might help the audience by trimming it. Touchstone is the one part that you can't really do that with until you have the actor with you doing it. Because they have to find his journey, and the thing about Touchstone is that he's like a piece of mercury. What he talks about, he's so in control of what he's saying. He's so clever with it that it is part of the performance. His language, if you like, is almost his best tool. And so, actually, no, to answer your question, I haven't really cut much of it at all. There's one very big speech, which feels like an aside that he does to the audience, which again, at the moment, I'm completely up for anything, pretty much. Yes. So that
is that the one about the lie?
No, that's right at the end.
Yes, yes.
This is one about cuckolding, really,
oh, yeah.
and about whether it's better for a man to get married and have the potential of being a cuckold, or to be a bachelor for the rest of your life.
Mm.
And so there's a moment where I want to wait and see what the audience, yeah. how the audience and the actor, what happens in that relationship, and I suspect that will tell me straight away whether we need
right.
that or not.
Yes.
So this is why the preview period is your crucial hour, really.
Yeah. There seems to be some building work going on there.
There's always building work going on in most rehearsal rooms, yeah. to be honest.
Anyway, it seems rather perverse to have started with Touchstone, so we really should start with Rosalind, shouldn't we? Who's played by Naomi Frederick, who is a lovely actress and has done quite a bit of Shakespeare before, hasn't she? What is it about her that gives you a Rosalind, do you think?
Well, I think Naomi has a very, very strong, grounded, immediate stage presence. She's quick as lightning, which I think Rosalind thinks very, very fast on her feet. She's very, very playful, which Naomi is. She's a lot of fun. And I think that Naomi has the depths to play such a fully rounded character who has to really experience the highs and the lows. You know, so before we even meet her, we know that her father's been banished, and so she's left. She's left almost as an orphan.
Yeah.
So there already is a huge emotion to kind of start with, and then very quickly into the play. Very surprisingly, she suddenly meets Orlando. She meets this man, and she has an absolute kind of head-on collision yeah. almost with him. But then again, because of the circumstances of her uncle, the Duke, she gets banished and forced to live in a world without him.
Mm.
So her story is completely timeless, but is by definition the story of a very, very together, complex, curious beast.
But she also has to be convincing as a boy.
She has to be completely...
While at the same time still being a woman.
She does, yeah.
Which, of course, might have been even harder, or I'm not sure if it was, if you'd started off being a boy.
Being a boy in the first place, yes. I know. Well, the layers of jokes kind
yeah.
of go a little bit deeper if you were a boy to begin with.
Yeah.
But yes, Naomi just physically has a... I think we've got a shot at the real sort of androgynous feel behind Ganymede.
Which, of course, is a name not chosen at random, is it?
Not chosen at random, no.
the cupbearer of the gods, who was known to be homosexual. So.
Yeah, I mean, essentially...
A beloved boy.
A beloved boy, absolutely. But, you know, very clever that that's immediately
yes.
the name. You know,
yes.
by saying that, it helps you to assume that she is a boy. You know,
yeah.
why would you ever assume otherwise?
Yeah.
Yes, no, and I mean Naomi is absolutely ready to really try and throw herself into the boyness of Ganymede,
yeah.
As much as the girlness of Rosalind.
Yeah. But the Rosalind that she sort of invents a Rosalind when she's talking about Rosalind in inverted commas for Orlando's benefit, doesn't she? Who isn't quite the same as the Rosalind we know.
No, she? But that's all. As you say, that's all about testing Orlando
yeah.
and seeing how he's going to react to the various things that she puts in front of him.
Mm.
So if she, as a boy, has a particular attitude to women, if Orlando finds it easy to kind of jump on that bandwagon and come with her and say, yeah, God, yeah, women, oh, mm. God, yeah, God, they're just like that, aren't they? Then that's going to tell the real Rosalind
yeah.
a lot about what this boy...
Yeah.
And her potential life partner is going to be like.
Does he at all fall in love with Ganymede, the boy, or is he? Is there a confusion there?
It's very interesting, that whole area,
mm.
And it's not clear in the text as to exactly what
mm.
what happens and how it happens. So it's completely up for interpretation. In my view, he gets closer and closer to Ganymede, genuinely finds a friendship there, and is and flirts with this interesting creature. But for me, he never really loses sight of his Rosalind and why he's there and why he's agreed to play this game. And just the constant use of Rosalind, the name keeps coming back, and that, for me, reminds him all the time. as to what he's, as I say, why he's agreed to play this. But having said that, I think there's also a choice to be made as to whether Orlando ever discovers, and if he does, when that is.
Yes, I was going to ask you that.
I don't know if I should give that away, but I suppose there's no reason really why I can't. But for me, he does.
It'll be obvious to the audience, presumably, once you... Or will it?
I hope it will be clear if you're looking for that. But
yeah.
It's so subtle that if you didn't know it at all and you were genuinely coming for the first time, you didn't know what the story was going to be like. That's quite a subtle thing to pick up on. Otherwise, it would be clear in the text, wouldn't it? But certainly for us, for me anyway, there is a moment where he does realise it, at which point he turns the tables and says, I don't want to play this game anymore. I just want you to be you. And the ball, if you like, is then in her court.
Right. And that precipitates
and the actual wedding itself.
Yes. I know one director thought that Oliver realised that she was a woman when she fainted at the sight of blood, thinking Orlando was injured, and told his brother, their relationship now being rather different.
Yeah.
But then James Shapiro, in his book, thinks that it's at the wedding that Celia pretends to hold. And
yeah, I think that it's more... I think it's in that scene.
Yeah.
I think it's in that scene. And therefore, when Oliver comes back in and meets the girls, he already knows that Ganymede is, in fact, Rosalind.
Yes. The way they address them at that point seems to suggest that they know. They both know that they're talking to women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At one point, Oliver says, "Hello, fair sister." And, again, why on earth would he say that to a boy, even though the boy is playing and being
because
Rosalind?
It's not his game.
It's not his game, so why would he enter into that? I think, if anything, it's the other way, that he forgets that he's meant to be addressing her as a boy.
But it is wonderfully confusing.
It is wonderfully confusing. And I think, for me, it's up to the director to make a choice so that the actors then have a very clear story to play. If for any reason you discover along the way that the text goes against that and gives you reason for that not to be the case, fine.
I think it's easier to see Orlando as her equal at the end if he does guess.
I completely agree. I think it's very, very dangerous if he doesn't know all the way up to her being revealed.
Yes.
It can make him look incredibly stupid.
Yes. And you want to, because we've already got to put up with his terrible verses and get over that.
Absolutely. he's a very angry boy in the beginning. Then he, then he has this big fight, and then he, as you say, writes this terrible poetry, and then has to keep this game up for so long that you kind of, I think, your patience with him can run out, and I think that's very unfair on him and obviously on the actor. But also, I think it's more interesting if the tables are turned and suddenly Rosalind... for me, then, what's interesting is the moment when Rosalind realises that Orlando realises.
Yes.
That, for me, is a really crucial moment.
Yeah. It doesn't stop her being a stage manager, though, does it? It's sort of organising that part at the end.
No, but I think it does make her realise that the game's up.
Yes.
And it's time for her to make a choice now.
Yes. Do you think that Orlando, in the first scenes, is given a lot of male attributes to make it quite clear to us that he's very much the man before he starts playing the sort of soppy lover and being taken in?
I hadn't thought of it like that, but maybe.
Because he's quite violent, in fact, isn't he? If he can beat Charles the wrestler, he must be very angry.
He's quite violent, although there's lots of different ways of doing
that. Yes, of course. He might just be clever at it.
Yeah, or lucky, even.
Yeah.
And of course, he at the beginning is playing a lot of the pain of losing his father
yeah.
is absolutely
yeah.
you know it's, that's yeah. at the basis of who he is at the beginning.
Yeah.
So much so that he doesn't care if he dies in the wrestling because he doesn't quite know what he's got to live for. So
His brother Oliver, who's a real villain at the beginning, I mean, he has a tremendous about
turn,
doesn't he?
He does, yeah. But I mean, Shakespeare's very good at writing those. And for me, I think
he turns out to be okay after all when he falls in love with Celia.
Well, even before then, he has this huge conversion on his way.
Into the forest,
yeah, yeah. So you know, we last see him, you know, really being threatened by the Duke. You better go and get go and find your brother and bring him back to me. And in the meantime, I'm going to take your lands and take everything you possess, and anything that means anything to you now belongs to me. So we see that moment, and I think it's very believable very easy to imagine somebody going from that extreme place on a long journey to go and find his brother, and along the way, on his own, you know, suddenly having a complete change of kind of soul and suddenly everything that he held high, you know, possessions and land and being the main inheritor from his father, has disappeared. That's not there anymore.
Yeah.
And you only really have those discussions with yourself, if you like, once when you're on your own, you know, and there's no one else there to have that with. So you have
but
to face yourself.
It's something about the play as well, though, isn't it? Because Frederick also...
Frederick does exactly the same thing.
Goes off a bit, yes.
Yeah. But again, I think that's something to do
this
with...
This is the usurping Duke, of course.
It's to do with the distance between the court and the forest.
Yes.
That, you know, I imagine that it's a good few days, that trek.
Yeah.
And so along that way, that's a real test. Mm. You know, Adam nearly doesn't do it because the old servant...
He's the old servant.
And for him, the journey, the arrival is such an important thing
exhausted.
That that's almost enough.
Yeah.
He's ready to die once he's arrived because that means he's taken Orlando all the way to the Forest of Arden. And as I say, that's it. He's done enough.
Well, you said Arden, not Arden.
I did say Arden.
But it is a strange place, though, isn't it? I mean, it's neither France nor England, but it is both and
an imaginary place. I mean, I think what's useful is the minute you hear Arden, because there's a familiarity to it, it makes you feel very calm as an audience member. You don't panic and say, oh, God, where? Or should I understand the geography of that? But at the same time, it's completely imaginary.
Because there are lions and palm trees as well as English sheep and...
Well, are there, is my question.
Ah, right. Oh, well, this is interesting. It's sort of...
There's no actual proof in the text that there are any lions at all.
Mm.
And for me, that is part of Orlando that comes just after Orlando's discovery of Rosalind. And so could it be that the lions are his way of getting back at her and testing her? So if his brother comes in with this story, the test being how is she going to react on seeing Orlando's blood of Orlando on a handkerchief.
Now he's turning into something quite calculating and...
Well, only doing what he's been given.
Yeah.
Only doing to her what she's been doing to him.
Oh, that's true, yes. That's true.
So,
No, but I meant in comparison with the Orlando that we sometimes see, who doesn't know anything until the...
No, I think ours is a bit more knowing than that.
Yeah.
And I think that's because our Rosalind is a very knowing Rosalind.
Yeah.
And that came out of rehearsals very naturally in terms of just matching them.
Right. Okay.
So it wasn't looked for, but it came out of it.
But the forest is a place where, a bit like A Midsummer Night's Dream, where changes happen.
Changes happen, and the changes that you need to happen will happen. And I think it is for every individual what it is they need it to be.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, because they see it in different ways, don't they?
Absolutely.
It's described as a desert. For Touchstone, the town boy, it's a dreadful place.
Which makes
place.
Complete sense,
yes,
and there he is with his posh clothes and he can't bear to get any mud on his stockings, you know, because it doesn't fit.
Yeah.
But of course
that
relationship changes.
Yeah. Celia's role is, because she's the one who instigates it all at the beginning, and then she becomes very much the little sister, although I noticed that Corin describes her as my mistress. My mistress's sort of brother is Rosalind, yeah. He's my master.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's because Celia is naturally a bossy and is often the leader.
Mm. She's a bit bemused by what happens, I suppose.
Well, I think it's that classic
she's
thing.
Horrified by the wedding that she's expected to do, isn't she?
Yeah. Well, I think she can't believe that Rosalind is feeling what she's feeling and wanting to do that. I mean, I keep seeing the play as a triangle between the three of them, and that it starts off with Rosalind and Celia, and then the triangle shifts so that you get Rosalind and Orlando on the same side, and it's continually where. So you know what I mean? It starts off with Orlando as the outsider, the third party, and then it shifts, and Celia needs to find who she is within that, and therefore redefine her relationship with Rosalind,
Which is much easier when she has her own love.
Yeah, but I think she's not ready for her love until her love comes in. So I think if he'd come any earlier, that wouldn't have happened.
Yes, yeah.
But there's something to do with her witnessing.
Yeah.
The journey that Rosalind goes on with Orlando, that although it's painful for her in some ways and she sees herself losing Rosalind, she is also now, unbeknown to her almost, she is now open and ready for love in a way that at the beginning she's absolutely not.
Yes, but they were more like girls in a boarding school sort of thing.
Yes, before. but Rosalind is already, she's already onto boys, and Celia isn't yet. But then, as I say, because of the relationship she has with Rosalind, and she's present in all of the Rosalind and Orlando scenes, she witnesses it.
Yeah.
And then before she knows it, in comes Oliver, and bingo.
Yeah. Yes. Of course,
this is what it is.
As somebody says, she has to be there to remind us, if we're watching a boy playing a girl playing a boy, that she's actually a girl. See what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because originally, people might have forgotten that if the boy was playing the boy, that she was still meant to be the girl.
Yeah, in fact, I had one of my actors on about week three who has a scene with the two of them, suddenly turned round and said, "Oh my God, but hang on, oh, it's a boy and a girl I'm having a conversation with." Because in his head, he sort of got it mixed up and was thinking, assuming that they were both dressed as boys.
Ah.
And I don't, you know, there's lots of levels of where that confusion came from.
Yeah.
But,
Yes. Well, it's a very theatrical play, and there's all this role play going on, and then at the end we have we actually have a mask, really, don't we?
Well, we have the God of Marriage.
Yes, but it's a bit like we have songs.
Songs? Mm. Yes, we have songs.
Mm. We have sort of set
pieces.
Yeah,
it's a kind of fantastical moment, isn't it?
Mm.
I think it's the only thing that's kind of bigger than Rosalind, if you know what I mean.
Yes. Oh, yes, I see.
She's sort of up to then being the kind of all-seeing, all-knowing puppeteer.
Yes.
And we need someone bigger than her to come in and...
To Phoebe. Or is she? Or does Phoebe just deserve it? Phoebe, who falls in love with Ganymede, not realising that Ganymede is a girl, when her Swain is following her about doggedly.
Yeah, my take on that at the moment is that the primary thing is that Rosalind, on first seeing Silvius, has huge empathy for him of what it's like to be in love but not having unrequited love. And so when she sees her friend Silvius being berated by Phoebe in the way that she does, that's what she's going in protect him.
Yes, because she's identifying so much with Silvius. Mm. Yes. Well, You have hopes for that marriage as well.
I do have hopes for that. I actually think they are...
Phoebe's going to realise
that
she's lucky.
They're meant to be together. Mm. Because you can't imagine Phoebe without Silvius. You can't imagine... Mm. All her energy comes from him.
Mm. Yes, I suppose his name means wood and hers means moon.
Yeah.
I don't suppose that's got anything to do with anything, really. It's just...
But they look nice together,
don't
they?
Yes, they do. I think I should probably let you get on with rehearsals because I know that you're quite keen to do so. So
only because we've only got a couple of days.
I know,
left.
And then you're into tech, so we'll
we are. I know. Next week already. It's amazing. Yes. Although tech at the Globe is an interesting concept.
Yes. Oh, I should have asked you. Have you built the stage out at all? Are you going into the yard? Or?
Yeah, we are. We're going into the yard a bit. We've got a couple of walkways so that we've got more entrances and a few trees.
Mm. And have you enjoyed being on the Globe stage rather than horrified by it?
Well, we haven't. I feel as though every time we've been there, it's slightly been in. It's like going to someone else's house.
Yeah.
And what happens on Monday is we move in and it becomes ours.
Yeah.
And that's the bit I'm really looking forward to being able to move in and to stay there. Whereas at the moment, we're allowed to have a sneaky peek or go on for an hour but then come off again. And it, you know, well, and then another show goes on. And it will be really nice for us just to really own it and make it our own. And so.
And you're avoiding the area between the pillars as much as possible.
Yeah, not easy, because that's the place you want to go to, isn't it? In any other theatre, that's where you'd spend most of your time. You have to be very careful about that. Again, that's what makes it even more unique, those pillars,
Just a few extra little things.
A few extra things to keep us on our toes.
Well, thanks very much, Theo.
It's a pleasure.